For too long, the world looked at our islands through a frosted glass. They saw the blue water and the white sand, but they did not see us. They heard the rhythm, but they did not understand the revolution. In the early 1970s, a sound began to crawl out of the concrete of West Kingston. It was not meant for a cruise ship or a luxury lounge. It was meant to be a hammer. When film cameras finally turned toward the Caribbean, they expected a postcard. Instead, they found a mirror that reflected a struggle they were not ready to face. Music was not just a background track for a story. In our history, the music was the story itself. It was the only weapon we had that could travel across oceans without a passport. This is the history of how our sound broke the lens of the world and forced them to listen to the truth of who we are. The year is 1972. The place is Kingston, Jamaica. The air is thick with the scent of diesel and the sound of a heartbeat that refuses to stop. Before this moment, the Caribbean was a phantom in the global mind. It was a place where people went to forget their lives, not to see the reality of others. Hollywood had spent decades painting our islands as a soft paradise filled with smiling faces and harmless songs. Then came a man named Ivanhoe Martin. He was played by Jimmy Cliff in a film called The Harder They Come. This was not a film about a vacation. This was a film about survival and the crushing weight of a system that offered no way out for a young man from the country. The soundtrack of this film did something that no diplomat or politician could do. It gave the world a raw, unedited line into the soul of the Jamaican people. Reggae was no longer just a local curiosity. It was a global broadcast of resistance. We must understand what was happening on the ground to understand why this music hit the world so hard. The 1970s were a time of intense political pressure. The promise of independence in 1962 had started to sour for many who still lived in the yards. There was a gap between the flag and the food on the table. The music filled that gap. When the film reached audiences in London and New York, they did not just see a movie. They heard a call to arms. The title track was a promise that the oppressed would rather go down fighting than live on their knees. This was the first time Caribbean music was used in media, not as a decoration but as a character. The drum and the bass were the pulse of the city itself. It was gritty, it was dangerous, it was undeniably real. The impact of this moment cannot be overstated. Before 1972, Caribbean artists were often forced to fit into the calypso mold if they wanted international attention. Calypso is a beautiful and complex art form, but the global north had turned it into a novelty. They wanted songs about rum and coconut water. They did not want to hear about the police or the hunger or the history of the plantation. The Harder They Come shattered that mold. It forced the viewer to reconcile the beauty of the melody with the harshness of the lyrics. It was the birth of the Caribbean hardline in media. We were no longer asking for a seat at the table. We were building our own table, and the music was the foundation. As the decade moved forward, the sound of the islands began to seep into every corner of the global consciousness. It was not just reggae. The influence of the sound system culture started to change how people in the Bronx thought about music. This was the beginning of a bridge between the islands and the diaspora that would eventually give birth to hip-hop. But in those early days, it was about the raw power of the dub plate. It was about the engineer in the studio stripping away the melody until only the truth of the rhythm remained. This was a sonic decolonization. We were taking the tools of the technology and making them speak our language. The world was watching, but they were also starting to feel a vibration they could not control. However, the gaze of the world is rarely pure. As the music grew in power, the industry began to look for ways to soften the edges. They saw the money, but they feared the message. The same sounds that were born in the struggle of the 1970s were being watched by men in suits who saw a different kind of opportunity. They wanted the rhythm without the revolution. They wanted the vibe without the victims. As the decade came to a close, the battle for the soul of Caribbean music in the media was just beginning. The lens had been shattered, but the pieces were being picked up by hands that did not belong to us. The question was no longer if they would listen, but what they would choose to hear. The 1980s brought a different kind of pressure to the sound of the Caribbean. The world had seen the grit, but now it wanted the gloss. The media machine began to realize that the Caribbean aesthetic was a powerful selling tool. but to sell it to the masses, they felt they had to sanitize it. This was the era of the tropical caricature. In 1989, a red crab named Sebastian appeared on cinema screens across the globe. He sang about life under the sea, with a thick accent that was supposed to represent us. The music was a polished version of calypso and reggae, meant to make children laugh and parents buy merchandise. For millions of people, this became the primary way they experienced Caribbean sound. It was a vacation in a bottle. It was a safe version of a history that was anything but safe. During this time, the steel pan became the universal signal for a break from reality. In television commercials and Hollywood films, the sound of the pan meant the characters were now in a place where nothing mattered. It was used to signal relaxation and lack of ambition. This was a profound insult to the history of the instrument. The steel pan was born in the hills of Trinidad as an act of defiance. It was created by people who were banned from using drums. They took the discarded oil drums of the industrial world and hammered them into a sophisticated orchestra. It was a triumph of human spirit over poverty and suppression. Yet in the media of the 80s and 90s, it was reduced to a sonic shorthand for a nap on the beach. We saw our innovations being used to reinforce the very stereotypes we had fought to break. Even when our artists reached the top of the charts, the pressure to conform was immense. Great talents like Eddie Grant or the group Arrow found global success with hits like Electric Avenue and Hot Hot Hot. These songs were brilliant, but the media often stripped them of their context. Electric Avenue was a song about the 1981 Brixton riots and the struggle of the working class in London. To the global audience, it was just a catchy pop song with a nice beat. Hot 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 became a wedding standard, played at parties where no one knew it was a celebration of Caribbean survival. The industry was taking the fruit of our labor and peeling away the skin until it was unrecognizable. This was a period of commercial dilution, where the sound was everywhere but the substance was hidden. The rise of the music video era further complicated this representation. Directors wanted the bright colors and the dancing, but they rarely wanted the story behind the movement. We were being framed as a backdrop for the fantasies of others. The Caribbean became a set piece. When a pop star from North America wanted to look edgy, they would borrow a dance hall beat and film in a colorful yard. They would use our fashion and our slang as a costume. This was cultural extraction in its most visible form. The media was using our pulse to sell a product that we did not own. We were being heard, but we were being spoken over. As the 90s progressed into the early 2000s, the tension between authenticity and commercialism reached a breaking point. The digital age was starting to provide new ways for the music to travel. The gates of the traditional media companies were still guarded, but the walls were starting to crack. People in the streets of London, Toronto, and New York were tired of the caricature. They wanted the real thing. They wanted the sound that reminded them of home or showed them a world they had never seen. The pressure was building for a new kind of ownership. The caricature had served its purpose for the industry, but the creators were ready to take back the narrative. The trap was set, and the next generation was about to spring it. The turn of the millennium changed the rules of the game forever. Technology allowed the sound of the islands to bypass the old gatekeepers. We did not need a Hollywood studio to tell our story anymore. We had the internet, and we had the diaspora. The 2010s saw the rise of artists who refused to soften their sound for the global ear. Sean Paul took dancehall to the center of the pop world without losing the patois or the heavy bass. Rihanna became a global icon who carried the flag of Barbados in everything she did. She did not just enter the media world, she redefined it. She showed that a Caribbean woman could be the boss of the narrative and the business. This was not the sanitized version of the 80s. This was power. Then came the era of the algorithm. In the last 10 years, the sound of the Caribbean has become the literal heartbeat of global pop music. From the reggaeton explosion to the rise of what the industry calls tropical house, the influence is everywhere. But there is a new danger in this success. When a sound becomes a template, it can easily be stolen. We see major artists from every continent using the rhythms of dancehall and soca without ever giving credit to the source. They call it a global sound, but they forget to mention where the globe got it from. In the age of TikTok, a dance from a street in Kingston can go viral in a day. But the person who created it often sees none of the profit. The extraction has become digital. Yet there is a new sense of ownership in our history. The creators are now the curators. Social media has allowed the authentic culture to speak directly to the world. When a film like Black Panther uses the sounds of the diaspora, it is doing so with a level of respect and research that was missing in the past. We are seeing a generation of filmmakers and musicians who understand that representation is not just about being seen, it is about being heard on your own terms. We are no longer the background noise. We are the architects of the soundscape. The 2026 landscape of media is one where the Caribbean sound is not a subgenre. It is the foundation. We must look at this journey from 1972 to today as a long war for the airwaves. It began with a man in a movie theater in Kingston, and it continues with every stream and every upload. The stakes have never been higher. As our music continues to dominate the charts, we have to ask if we are winning the battle for the mind. True representation is not just having our songs played. It is having our history respected. It is making sure that when the world hears the drum and the bass, they know the blood and the sweat that went into it. We have moved from the shadow to the center stage. Our history is not a commodity. It is a living, breathing thing that travels through the speakers and the screens. We have broken the lens that tried to distort us, and we have built a new way of seeing. The global engine of culture now runs on Caribbean fuel. We must ensure that we are the ones steering the ship. The music was always our most honest witness. It told the truth when the world wanted a lie. Now that the world is finally listening, we have a responsibility to keep speaking the truth. The rhythm belongs to us, but the message belongs to the future. If we lose the story, we lose the soul. We are the keepers of the sound, and we are not finished yet.